the ability to isolate the body or to keep the temperature of the body within norm. Besides other functions. And we all know that the skin is composed of an outer layer called the epidermis. Underneath is the dermis and the subcutaneous tissue. Of course, the dermis is the thicker part and the one responsible for the elasticity you notice in the skin. And it causes and contains the skin appendages in the form of sweat glands, sebaceous glands, blood vessels, hair, and nails. Skin appendages are very important source of
surgery.
The first part of the lecture, we will talk about the burns. Burns used to cause what used to be one of the causes of this before. The burn patient used to die because of hypovolemia. Then the science discovered that the patients with burn would lose a lot of fluid, so we should replace these fluids. But still, the patients then started to die from infections. Then we developed the techniques of debridement and the early debridement, skin grafting, plus the topical and antimicrobial. But still, burns are considered a major cause of death. And usually, death is caused by smoke inhalation, pneumonia, or even shock. Mortality in burns are especially common in elderly. We can know the severity of the burn or the percentage of the mortality by adding the age of the patient plus the body surface area, which will give us an estimate about the percentage of mortality. Patients who are at risk for death, burn patients who are at risk for death are patients who have more than 40% total body surface area burn, or patients who are older than 60 years, or patients who have inhalation injury. Talk about the pathophysiology of burn. The injury of burn is a dynamic process. It depends on the temperature of the insulting agent plus the duration the skin has been in contact with that insulting agent, which will lead to injury of the skin. The skin or the injury area can be divided into three areas: central area of necrosis, zone of stasis. When you say zone of stasis, this is the area at risk of becoming necrotic. And when we start IV fluid management and topical antimicrobials, the aim is to reverse the zone of stasis to be a zone of hyperemia, or to save it from being a zone of necrosis. The outer zone is the zone of hyperemia, and as we can see here in the diagram, this is the zone of necrosis. This is irreversibly damaged skin. This is the zone of stasis that we want to save to become a normal skin, surrounded by the zone of hyperemia. Maybe it is not so clear. The injury of the burn is not isolated to the area affected or the skin affected. When we reach a percentage of 20% or more, the whole body will react to that injury. There will be a release of histamine, bradykinase, release of free radicals, which will lead to intense systemic inflammatory response syndrome. This will lead to hypermetabolism. It will affect the blood supply to the gut, leading to loss of the villi and bacterial translocation. We mean by bacterial translocation, the bacteria within the gut will translocate into the blood and the patient will have sepsis. This process can lead to the end result of multi-organ failure and death. Now we will talk about the degree of burn. you hear us always talking about superficial burn, deep burn, second degree burn, and when we say that, we are actually describing the level of injury at the skin. So usually first degree burn is the burn which affects only the epidermis, while a second degree burn, it is the burn which will affect the dermis, usually the upper part of the dermis, and it also can be divided into superficial or deep, depending on the amount of skin or the dermis damage and the skin appendages in relation. The third degree burn, or we have a third degree burn when there is full thickness burn, the epidermis and the whole dermis is affected by the burn. This is a table showing the differences between the three degrees of burn. So, can somebody tell me what is this?
Second.
Why did you say second?
Less.
Because it is physical or fully. This is right, but it is still short answer.
Second superficial.
So this is the superficial second degree. So what about these areas? Which areas?
First degree.
So most of the time when you see a picture of a burn, it actually contains two or more degrees of burn. We don't always see only one degree. Usually it is mixed because we have, or because we know about the pathophysiology and the zones of injury. So when we say this is the central areas, correspond to the zone of necrosis, okay? This is the mostly damaged area, usually in the center. When we go to the periphery, we usually have a less damaged skin. What about this one?
Oh.
It's very easy.
Third degree.
This is a third degree. عشان حطيتها ثانية حتكون سكن. What about this one?
A third.
Third. في شيء واحد في degree بعد.
Skin.
Skin means what? There was a large physical. So?
Second.
Second. Which time of second degree?
Deep.
Okay. But, you know, in practice or in reality, it is really difficult to give the, or to tell the exact degree of the burn on, you know, when you see the first, when you first time, when it was the first time for you to see the patient. Usually, we can reach to the degree after we see the patient twice, first time at presentation, and then 24 to 48 hours, because there is, as we said, there is a zone of stasis that might go into zone of necrosis, so it will not be always as clear as these pictures. Now, so you saw a patient in the emergency, and you determined that this patient has this kind of degree of a burn. The second step is to tell the percentage of the burn, or the extent of the burn. It is important because this will determine our therapy and it will also give us an idea about the prognosis the patient will have. Usually we describe the extent of the burn as a percentage of the total body surface area. For patients or for adult patients, so patients above 9 years old, usually we use the rule of 9. It's very simple. Remember, this is anterior, this is posterior. Mm-hmm. So each flank is 18, the head and neck is 4.5 anterior. So the total area head and neck is 9. The whole upper limb is 9. Anterior trunk 18, posterior trunk 18. The whole lower limb is 18. When you calculate it, it comes 99. The remaining person at the groin area or genitalia. This is good for adults. What about children? No. My group is in my house.
depending on the age.
Huh?
The age.
According to the age, there is a chart that we go through. We call it lung and bladder chart. Okay, because, you know, kids have a different surface area. Actually, they have a larger vertebral surface area. The head and neck is usually bigger in children. That's why it's different than adults. So we need to go, we need to use the chart. When we see a pediatric patient, we have a similar chart like this in the ward. We mark the area that is burned. We go against these figures to figure out the total body surface area. So I heard somebody who said the palm. When do we use the palm?
Percentage.
Touch or touch.
Yeah. When there is different small patches all over the body. It's not a big surface area that you can calculate. There is a small patch on the arm, small patch on the leg, small patch on the trunk. So in order to determine that, we use our palm to determine the percentage.
How is the patients?
Yeah. It is of the patient. Okay? So because some people say, okay, I'll use my palm to be easier, it is an estimate. You see the palm of the patient and you compare it. And the palm of the patient equals
1%.
Another important thing to determine on examining the patient is the presence of circumferential burns at the chest, neck, lips. Because, as we said, a full thickness or a third degree burn is like, the feeling of it is leathery. And when we say leathery, it means like the leather on your bags, it has no elasticity. So this might limit the movement of the chest, leading to difficult ventilation. And when it is around the limbs, it will lead to
circulation.
Yeah, it will affect the circulation. Because the muscles in the limb is enclosed in
compartments
by deep fascia. And it has no space to expand. So circumferential burn with the generalized edema of that the patient will have due to the burn, he will have swelling of the muscles, and the swelling of the muscles will reduce the blood supply going to the muscle. So we need to assess the vascularity of the limbs when we see a circumferential burn, and if there is a compromise, we need to take the patient to OR to do these incisions in the burned skin. And what do we call the burned skin? When you have
it's
a full thickness burn, we call it ishkar. And when we release it, we call it ishkarotomy. And these are the signs of ishkarotomy that we usually do. This is an example of a full thickness burn. You see blackish, whitish, leathery skin, and there is the ishkarotomy sign. When we take the history in a burn patient, it's very important to know the circumstances of the burn. And one good example is that patients who had burn in a closed space, they might have inhalation injury, as we said to the group yesterday, that it has three main parts. The first one is the upper airway obstruction, which is mainly in patients who have head and neck burn. And it's very important because if the edema develops in the upper airway, the patient will have upper airway obstruction and we will lose the patient. That's why it's very important to determine if the patient has such injury or not, because if he has, we need to do intubation as early as possible. The other part is the injury to the lung from the chemicals inhaled. This will lead to chemical pneumonitis, followed by pulmonary edema, then pneumonia. And as we said in the beginning of the lecture, pneumonia is one of the common causes of death in burn patients. The other part is the nature of the toxic material inhaled. If the patient inhales carbon monoxide, then he would have carbon monoxide poison. The typical signs is confusion, dizziness, and usually the treatment is with 100% FiO2. Sometimes we need to take the patient to the ICU. This depends on the level of the carbon monoxide in the blood. This diagram is just to show the, you know, the mechanism of developing the pneumonia and the pulmonary fibrosis. There will be injury to the bronchial tree, plus activation of the general inflammatory response in the lung. This will lead to an end result of pulmonary edema, pneumonia, and pulmonary fibrosis. So you saw the patient, you determine the percentage of the burn, you determine the degree of the burn, you know all the circumstances of the burn. Of course, how to take a history of the burn, this is the mission or the job of the tutor who gives you the session in, or about burn. So you took a good history, you determine the percentage and the degree. So we need to know what to do with the patient. Should you refer him? Let's say you are working in small dispensary or a hospital at the periphery. So you need to know, does this patient require referral to a higher center, or should you manage him at home or with just topical antimicrobial? These are usually the referral criteria. If you have a partial thickness burn greater than 10% at any age, third degree burn at any age, burns involving critical areas like the face, hands, palms, soles, genitalia. If there is electrical chemical burn, if there is an element of inhalation injury, if there is a pre-existing medical disorders like diabetes or hypertension, patients of motor vehicle accidents, they have burns, so you should not be should not direct all your attention to the burn, but you should also concentrate on other injuries that may occur with the motor vehicle accidents. And patients who have special social, emotional, or long-term rehabilitative intervention. This includes children with suspected child abuse. The most important factor in the management of low risk of burn patients is good hydration, because as you said, when you lose the skin, you start to lose fluids. And when you have a major burn, more than 20%, the patient develops generalized systemic inflammatory response syndrome, which means he will lose fluids into the third space. So not all the fluids will go out, but also he will lose it into the interstitial space. So the main or the cornerstone of the treatment is fluid resuscitation. And as we said, hypovolemia was a major cause of death before. Now we need to, so when you see the patient who have a burn more than 20%, you should start him on IV fluid resuscitation. There are so many formulas, but the most important is the Parkland formula. What you need to know about Parkland, that it uses crystalloids. Do you know the difference between crystalloids and keloids? Okay. The IV fluid usually divided into two main types, crystalloids and colloids. Colloids that contain, you know, a high molecular weight substrate like albumin, while crystalloids are isotonic like Ringer lactate or normal saline. So Parkland formula uses crystalloids, and it uses at this. This is the formula. It's 4 mL per percentage per kg. Okay. So you need to say that you have a child who is 10 years old, whose weight is 10 kg, and the total body surface area, let's say, 10. What's the IV fluid rate? Or the total IV fluid he should receive in the first 24 hours? 4 by 10 by 10. Okay? Just a minute. So. The most common type of burn is the thermal burn, which is burn caused by heat. Thermal burns can be divided into scald burn, which is burn caused by hot liquids, flame burn, burn caused by fire, okay, or when contact burn, which is the burn caused by contact to the hot object. There are, you know, other special types of burn, like the electrical burn, which is caused by the passage of electrical currents, and we divide it usually into a low voltage and a high voltage. The low voltage less than 1,000, while the high voltage more than 1,000 volts. When you have electrical burn, high voltage, you look for systemic effects, like cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, or demyelination of the spinal cord. These patients should be admitted and monitored with ECG, cardiac enzyme. The other special type is the chemical burns. Chemical burns are divided into burns caused by acid or burns caused by alkali. And which is worse? Alkali. Because alkali causes more disfection because they cause liquefaction process that they liquefy the skin, liquefy the tissues, and make them. While acids cause coagulation necrosis. The worst type of chemical burns is the burn caused by hydrogen, because it is an acid, causes an acid burn, and at the same time the fluoride ion will be released, and it will cause burn in the same way as alkali burns, in that it will cause liquefaction necrosis, and when the fluoride ions reach to the bone, they cause decalcification of the bone with release of calcium, leading to arrhythmia. So this concludes the first part of the lecture about. Do you have any questions? Flame contact scald caused by hot liquid. Okay. And actually it's the most common type of burn you see, it's called burn. Yeah. 4 degrees is very rare. 4 degrees when the burn or the injury reaches to the deep structure, which leads to necrosis of muscle or bone, tendons or nerve. But this is very rare. But there is a problem, yeah. Okay, next part, or the second part of the lecture, we'll talk about wound healing. So, regardless of the cause of the injury or the wound, you know, wounds will heal always the same way. With difference in the timing and intensity. Otherwise, the process of wound healing is the same in all time. So, whenever there is a break in the epidermis and the dermis, the process of wound healing starts immediately. You should know that wound healing is composed of three main phases. Inflammatory phase, proliferative phase, and maturation phase. There is a lot of things about wound healing, but what is important for you to know? What are these stages? When do they start? When do they finish? What is the aim of each phase? And what is the cells or the main stage? So we'll start by talking about the inflammatory phase. So, inflammatory phase starts immediately, so day one, and lasts up to 10 days. The initial phase of the inflammatory phase, it is what's known as hemostasis. So there will be vasoconstriction in order to prevent bleeding or blood. This vasoconstriction usually lasts for minutes. What is the aim of the inflammatory phase? The aim is to limit and prevent further injury, because whenever there is a break in the skin, there will be bacteria, there will be contamination. So the aim of the inflammatory phase is to further injury.
No.
Now, the phases of wound healing is not like separate phases. They actually overlap. So before the first phase ends, the second phase usually already starts. You know? So the first phase, you can say that starts at day 5. So before the end of the inflammatory phase. And from it will last for 3 weeks. And as you can tell from the end, is regeneration. Build the tissue defense. Okay. So there will be formation of new vessels, of new capillaries, and we call this
angiogenesis.
Okay. At the end, there will be granulation tissue. Do you know granulation tissue? Did you see a granulation tissue before? Okay, so whenever you see a wound that is left for 3 days or 5 days, you'll find a red, easily bleeding tissue at the base of the wound. This is the granulation tissue. It is composed mainly of capillaries. Besides the extracellular matrix, there's hyaluronic acid, besides the chondroitin sulfate and other components. But the most important thing component of granulation tissue is the capillaries. At day 3 to day 5, now the building cells come, okay, which is the fibroblast. The fibroblast become the dominant cells at day 7. The aim of the fibroblast is to replace the scaffold that we talked about, which is composed mainly of fibrin, to replace it with collagen. Does anybody know what is the composition, the collagen composition of the normal skin? Do you know that there is types of collagen?
Yeah.
Okay, how many types are there?
Four.
There are actually more than 8 of collagen. Okay. But the most common to us, or the things that we can barely remember, are the first four. So in the normal skin, there is mainly type 1 and type 3. To make it easy to remember that the ratio of type 1 to 3 is 3 to 1. Okay? So the predominant type is 1. When there is injury, the fibroblast will replace the fibrin with collagen. Which type? No. It will start by replacing it by type 3. Okay? With time, this 3 will also be replaced into 1. So, if I ask you what is the... You should also... Very important. You should know which type of collagen and where it is present. But when we ask you what is the dominant type of collagen in normal skin, you will say 1. So the ratio of 1 to 3 is 3 to 1. It's actually 4 to 1, just to make it easier to remember. But when I say what is the predominant collagen in the beginning of the proactive phase, you will say
3.
Okay. Now, collagen, or actually it is fibrin, which is the responsible for the tensile strength. When we mean by tensile strength, you know, when there is a wound, you want to open it, it cannot open. The resistance to this force, we call as the tensile strength, just to make it easy. The fibrin is the one initial for the strength of the wound, but it is actually, or the final strength depends on the collagen. To make things easy, we say that the wound tensile strength will reach 60% by 6 weeks. The final tensile strength will be 80%, which means that a wounded skin will never reach to the normal tensile strength. And you should know that the tensile strength is reached, or most of it is reached at 6 weeks. Why? The 20% is reached during 1 to 2 years. Okay, which is the, which phase of wound healing?
Maturation.
Your operative phase is going to stop at which
time?
At what time? 3 weeks. By year?
Maturation.
No, so there is now the, there is an inflammatory phase that aims to clean the wound, then there is the pleurative phase that builds the, or replaced the missing part of the collagen, which is, the collagen is present in which part? The epidermis or dermis? Okay, so the inflammatory phase now clean down. We have the proliferative phase built up the collagen for us, so it replaced the dermis. So we are left now with what? With the epidermis. Okay, epithelial cells, keratinocytes. Now this physical barrier is replaced by a process called epithelialization. It is controlled by many growth factors, but what is important is to know that it is composed of three parts. Mobilization. You imagine that, you know, say that we lift this wound to heal by itself. So this defect here, first day, you will see after a few days, this wound is cleaned by the inflammatory phase. Then the proliferative phase will build us a scar here, which is composed of collagen. Now we are left with the epidermis. So the cells will come from where?
The edge.
From the edge. Okay. So if we have a partial thickness burn, the cells will come from the edges plus the appendages. Okay? We said the appendages are a source of keratinocytes. So these cells, in order for these cells to reach into the middle of the wound, they need to migrate, and in order for them to be able to migrate, they need to lose their contact inhibition. After loss of contact inhibition, these cells will migrate and reach to the middle of the wound. And once they reach or they meet the other cell from the other side, there will be restoration of contact inhibition. Okay. There will be also a continuous supply of these cells by continuous mitosis as the skin itches and the skin avenue. The last phase of wound healing is the maturation. It starts at week 3 and it will last for 1 year. And the aim of it is to replace type 1, to replace type 3 by type 1. After 6 weeks, it is mainly type 1 which is predominant, but still the tensile strength is increased by organization of the collagen fibers and increased cross-linking. Nerves will also regenerate. Usually the nerves will regenerate at 1 millimeter per day. Okay. Now we'll talk about the results of wound healing. So if the wound heals, there will be contraction. When you come to our clinic, plastic surgery clinic, you'll hear us talking about contraction and contraction. So, is there a difference between these two?
Yeah.
Contraction is actually the physiological process. which means the shrinkage or the three-dimensional shrinkage of the wound. The aim of it is to reduce the scar area. This is, you know, when you hear it, something good, that the scar area, instead of having a big scar, it's a small scar. This is good. But in certain places, this might lead to functional or lead to limitation in the function. And at that time, you call it contracture. Okay? So, this patient has
contraction.
A contracture, because the contraction of the scar led to limitation in the movement of the neck. What is the cell behind this? It is the myofibroblast. It is the same as a fibroblast, but it possesses a smooth muscle character. Another important thing to know, or to also hear us talk about, primary closure, secondary closure, and tertiary closure. So if you have patients with this one, suture is what? What type of closure? It's a primary closure. Why would not leave it to heal by itself? Because of the deformity. Okay? Because it will lead to deformity. The other thing, the wound is clean. It's not contaminated. Okay? So I immediately, when you see this wound in the ER, we clean and we suture. There is no problem. This one. You can imagine this. This is the, I think this is the abdomen, the umbilical. This is a big wound and a contaminated wound. So what would you do? Why the casting grab? Damn skin grab.
We clean the wound. We try to drain it, and then some suture.
So we need to clean the wound, but because it's big and it is contaminated, once cleaning is not enough. So we need to clean it several times. We do dressings to clean the wound. Then we will close the wound, okay? By a skin graft or by a flap or by whatever. This type of management is called, well, tertiary. Okay? We call it tertiary. So it is delayed primary closure of contaminated wound, initially treated to control the infection. This is the definition of tertiary. So, can somebody give me an example of a secondary closure of the wound? That secondary, that you leave the wound to heal by itself. You don't do anything to it. Maybe just dressing.
Blisters?
Huh?
I feel like vesicles or...
Yeah, well, it can be vesicles, you see me? Superficial second degree burn. Okay. This is an example of a burn that we leave it to heal by secondary infection. So you saw an example of a wound that needs primary closure. When you have a clean wound, full thickness wound, okay, you need to close it primarily. If you have a superficial wound, you need to heal by secondary infection. If you have a contaminated wound, you deal with it as a tertiary, you deal with it with cleaning, followed by closure, and you call this tertiary wound closure. Clear? Right. So, whenever there is wound healing, there is always a scar. Okay? And scars can be abnormal. The most, you know, devastating of these abnormal scars is keloids. Did you hear ever about keloids?
Yes.
Hypertrophic scar?
Yes. Yeah.
You know that there is a difference between the keloid and hypertrophic scar?
Yes.
Yeah. Huh? are very similar to Happy Perfect Scar. That's why there is a lot of tables, you know, with the differences between with the both. But the most important difference is keloids go out or go beyond their border. Okay? So this is the keloid of the air tubule. Most of the time it is due to ear piercing. So the wound of ear piercing is very tiny, 1 millimeter or 2 millimeter. While the keloid here is very huge. So it's very clear that it is beyond its body. The cause of it is unknown. So we cannot prevent it. There is some people have the you know, the propensity, or they have, you know, they have it in their blood to have keloids. And usually it affects the area above the clavicle. For example, the deltoid area here, the air review, and also the sternum. It has some genetic component, because some say that it is autosomal dominant and it is present in people who have a darker skin. But since we don't know the exact cause, it's very difficult to prevent, and at the same time it's very difficult to treat, because usually we treat hypertrophic scars with steroid injections, silicone sheets, or sometimes surgical excision. But keloids, they are very poor, they respond to these modalities very poorly, and sometimes we treat them as cancer, doing aggressive excision plus radiation. Here is an example of hypertrophic scar. So hypertrophic scar are confined within the border. The risk factors for developing hypertrophic scar is leaving the wound to heal by itself. For example, the first picture we saw, the wound here, because it's a full thickness wound, if you leave it to heal by secondary infection, the patient will have a hypertrophic scar. Okay. Also, if you do incorrect, if you exert so many tension, some people, when they excise the lesion, they excise so big, and then when they try to close the skin, it will be under tension. In this situation, the patient will be at risk of developing hypertrophic scar. The treatment of hypertrophic scars are steroids, silicone sheets, pressure garments, sometimes surgical intervention if there is excess tension. People of darker skin are also at risk of developing hypertrophic scars, and usually hypertrophic scars are more common among or at flexor surfaces of the upper. Usually you will find the hypertrophic scar at the flexor surface. Okay, you can find it across the, and when it crosses the joint, it will lead to? Contraction. There is a lot of factors that affect the wound healing. There is a lot of factors that affect wound healing. If there is too much bacteria, more than 10 to the power of 5, this means that there is a wound infection. The presence of bacteria will prolong which phase of wound healing?
Inflammatory phase.
So when there is a prolonged inflammatory phase, there will be a poor outcome, because the destruction is increased. Neutrophils will release more free radical scavengers. There will be more release of proteases. So the longer the neutrophils stay, the more it will take for the wound to heal and the poor outcome. There is the same thing if there is devitalized tissue or foreign bodies. Cytotoxic drugs are known of delaying wound healing, because they affect mitosis and they affect sometimes collagen cross-linking, which like, for example, penicillamine, which inhibits the collagen X-linking. If the patient has a chemotherapy, it's very important that he has no surgery until at least 2 weeks after the chemotherapy. The same thing for radiation. Systemic disorders can also affect wound healing, like diabetes, smoking due to the vasoconstriction, atherosclerosis, reduced blood supply to the wound, malnourishment of the albumin at below level, vitamin D deficiency, scurvy, steroid use will inhibit the key player in the inflammatory phase, which is the macrophage. Denervation usually has no effect on wound healing, but still you see patients who have aesthetic limbs develop chronic wounds. Can somebody tell me why? And getting good denervation has no effect on wound healing. But paraplegic patients who have no sensation here, they develop pressure ulcers, chronic wounds. Yeah, and just simply because they don't feel. So when they don't feel the area, there will be there will be pressure for a long time. There will be necrosis, and they will develop the wound. But the innervation itself, if you protected the patient from pressure, you will have a normal wound healing. There's some other genetic factors like osteogenesis imperfecta, which is defect in type 1 collagen. Scurvy, vitamin C deficiency, Marfan syndrome, epidermolysis bullosa, and that's it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.